Now former inmates get out and listen quietly as he hands out train tickets and money.
Your ticket's stapled to the back of your envelope. Freeman?
Yeah.
Knight? Yeah.
Each inmate gets back the money he's got in his commissary account. But many don't have any money in their accounts, so they're given $10. All of the men are wearing gray, prison-issued sweatsuits that are exactly the same. And most carry a large envelope or two with their release papers and other documents. And most also have either a small bag or a shoebox with their belongings.
A shirt, sweater, you know. There's a little simple stuff, you know.
Ryan Freeman was in Vandalia for a gun charge and is headed home to family in Englewood on Chicago's south side.
Had to keep my Bibles, you know, stay in contact with the Lord, you feel me? Because he's the only one that got me through what I got through, you know, what I had to go through.
I'm Terry Lawhorn from Kankakee, Illinois.
Like a lot of men just leaving prison, Lawhorn is carrying few possessions, but a lot of baggage. Still, of all the men I talked to on this day, Lawhorn strikes me as the most likely to not return to prison. He says this was his first time inside after dealing cocaine for 23 years without getting caught. But he says he's learned his lesson.
Really hurt my family a lot. Kids probably hurt more than anything. A lot of embarrassment. This is something I wouldn't want to take the family through again. So it's over for me. I mean, I'll leave it to the young guys that want to deal with all that. As long as I got a roof over my head, some food on the table, stick close to Jesus, and I'll live the rest of my life, you know, being content with that.
Everyone leaving prison says they're done committing crimes, but of course that's often not the case. But Lawhorn has more going for him than most of the men waiting for the train. He's got a wife, two kids, and perhaps most important, given how hard it is for ex-felons to get hired, he owns a small business.
Well, I do landscaping and snow removal. I've been doing it for 14 years in Kankakee. But I've got an opportunity to go to Roosevelt University in Chicago. They sent me some papers to apply, so I'll probably try to get in there.
You've got a plan all set up?
Yeah, pretty much.
What do you think of some of these other guys that you look around? 50% of the people who come out of the Department of Corrections end up going back in. What's the difference between someone who's going to be fine on the outside versus someone who's going to end up back in?
A lot of guys don't have a plan, they don't have anything to look forward to, and the only thing they know is probably what they've been used to doing.
Another just-released inmate, Chester Ryan, heads into the train station because it's cold out, and the prison didn't give any of the men coats or even jackets.
The abundances, you know? It's a nice hoodie, but you're freezing and you're a little cold out there. Just jogging pants and a hoodie. I expected a jacket, hopefully.
Ryan, like many others at the station, has all his earthly belongings in a large shoebox.
This is what I own in this box. This is it.
Ryan is headed to Bloomington. He hopes to hit up a church soon to get some clothes, including a jacket, because he's wearing all the clothes he has. He's got a friend who will put him up for 2 months, but after that, he's afraid he'll be going to shelters. Ryan is a sex offender. He was in prison for child pornography. He says he's going to look at the sex offender laws in all the states and move to wherever the rules are most lenient.
It's smarter to look at the rules for each state and say, okay, which rules can you live with to stay out, to not go back to prison for a registry charge?
And it's not that Ryan wants to reoffend. He just doesn't want to end up back in prison for something like looking for work on a computer, which could violate some rules against being online, that kind of thing.
You know, I think they should have gave a person with one count of child pornography a second chance to say, hey, register for 10 years, 10, 15 years, instead of life. I think that's a little harsh, life.
My name is Dunlap, and I'm from the west side of Chicago. Going back to society again, and I wanted to basically just give myself a chance, you know.
Perrin Dunlap just served 8 months. It was his eighth time in prison. He's got burglary and theft charges, but he says for him, it all goes back to one thing.
Heroin. They say people, places, and things, but it wasn't the case. It's always something different. It was just that, you know, that desire, you know, that addiction is you know, it's poison, you know, and I know it, but thought that I could still do it.
As the train rumbles toward the station, the men in gray sweatsuits make their way from the parking lot to the platform. When the train stops, a conductor comes out and tells the now freed prisoners to stay where they are. He invites all the other people, families, couples, a small school group of some sort. All of them are invited onto the train first.
Watch your step, hold on to the handrails. You, everybody who's getting on board, go upstairs and go to the left.
No, see how they doing? That's crazy. Yeah, it be like that sometimes. So especially when you black, though. You know what I'm saying?
The slight is pretty much the first thing to happen to these men upon release from prison. A less than encouraging welcome back to society. But other than a few resigned murmurs, the men stay put and do as they're told. When they are allowed onto the train, they all get seats, though the car is pretty full. Perrin Dunlap looks out the window as the train cuts through flat fields of southern Illinois and talks about his next steps. He says there's a Catholic Charities facility in Chicago that he's hoping can help him out, and he plans to get a link card so he can get something to eat. He insists he's not going back to prison a ninth time.
I know in my heart I'm not about to go do anything. I already know that. I'm not trying to win you over, I promise you that. I'm trying to win none of that. I know in my mind and in my heart what I'm about to go do now.
When Dunlap gets to Chicago, he plans to walk from Union Station to the Pacific Garden Mission shelter south of Roosevelt on Canal. Like many of the other ex-felons on this train, Dunlap has just $10 in his pocket. Every year, more than 33,000 men and women are released from Illinois prisons and make a similar journey facing similar odds. That's about 127 people every single weekday. I'm Robert Wildeboer.
Join us again at this time tomorrow when Robert Wildeboer looks at how some people end up in prison. You might be surprised by some of the low-level offenses. One man got 4 years for stealing a license plate sticker. That's not an uncommon sentence, and we'll take a look at nonviolent felons in Illinois' prison system tomorrow on the Afternoon Magazine at 12:40. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine. Ford Motors has apologized for print ads depicting three bound and gagged women stuffed in the trunk of an Indian-made compact, the Ford Figo. The ads were created by an Indian agency and were not supposed to be distributed commercially, but they showed up online, and now Ford has apologized. NPR's Sonari Glinton has this report.
The ads were never used commercially. They were created by an ad agency hired in India by Ford, JWT India. The idea is that the trunk of Ford's Figo, a subcompact car, is so roomy, as the ads show, Paris Hilton could fit the Kardashian sisters bound and gagged in the trunk. Or Formula One driver Michael Schumacher could fit his male rivals, again, bound and gagged in the trunk. Ford spokesman Chris Preuss says the ads were part of a creative exercise that was never and would never have been approved by the company.
It would be impossible to speculate what would leave individuals with the idea that this would be seen as any kind of a creative exercise that would be considered noteworthy or remarkable other than for its indecency and being so contrary to the standards that we all hold to.
The ads have caused a stir, especially given India's recent turmoil over violence against women. They also come at a particularly bad time for Ford as the Indian car market becomes increasingly important and India grows its own car business. Again, Ford's Chris Preuss.
It's brought a lot of embarrassment to the company, and we'd just like to move on and make sure it never happens again.
In a statement, the ad agency JWT India apologized as well, saying, quote, actions have been taken within the agency to deal with the situation. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Russian oligarchs are in the news for a haircut in Cyprus, a death in London, billions all over. We check in on the post-Soviet robber barons. Plus, a look at the rise and fall of Phil Spector, creator of the Wall of Sound. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Tonight from 9 to 11 on AM 580.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 26th of March, 2013. It's the birthday of A.E. Housman, born Worcestershire, England, 1859, the poet who gave us the lines, "Loveliest of trees, the cherry now is hung with bloom along the bough and stands about the woodland ride wearing white for Eastertide." It's the birthday of Tennessee Williams, Columbus, Mississippi, 1911. Wanted to become a playwright when he was 18 and saw a production of Ibsen's Ghosts. His father made him go to work in a shoe factory, where Williams worked with a man whose name was Stanley Kowalski.
He wrote plays while he worked a variety of odd jobs, plays produced by small theater companies, didn't earn him much money. He was nearly broke in 1944 when The Glass Menagerie was produced, a big success, first in Chicago, then on Broadway. 3 years later came A Streetcar Named Desire, with Marlon Brando playing a character named Stanley Kowalski. It's the birthday of Robert Frost, 1874, in San Francisco. Moved to Massachusetts when he was 11. Struggled to become a poet. He was 39 before he published his first collection of poems, A Boy's Will. Robert Frost, who was out of fashion almost from the beginning, interested in traditional meter and rhyme when his contemporaries were writing in free verse. Early years were rough. Father was a heavy drinker, died of TB when the boy was 12. Family was left impoverished. Frost had to drop out of college during his first year to go to work. He was so depressed at one point he walked into the dismal swamp and considered drowning himself. Taught school for a few years, never enjoyed it. He and his wife Eleanor lost their first child. He fell into despair, barely making ends meet, his marriage on the rocks. That was the year he tried his hand at raising poultry on a 30-acre farm in Derry, New Hampshire. The farm inspired some fine poems, but Frost was a terrible farmer. And it's the birthday of the poet Gregory Corso, born on Bleecker Street in Greenwich Village, New York City, 1930. Gregory Corso, who said, "Standing on a street corner, waiting for no one, is power." His parents were Italian teenagers. Mother went back to Italy, left the baby behind. Corso said, "I never saw my mother. I don't know what happened to her." The father was drafted into the army. The boy spent his childhood in a series of orphanages, foster homes, jails. When he was 16, went to prison for 3 years for stealing food from a restaurant. In 1950, he met the poet Allen Ginsberg. Corso had started writing poetry in prison, and he became one of the leading poets of the Beat movement. Here's a poem for today by David Ignato, entitled Listening. "You wept in your mother's arms, and I knew that from then on I was to forget myself. Listening to your sobs, I was resolved against my will to do well by us. And so I said without thinking, in great panic, to do wrong in one's own judgment, though others thrive by it, is the right road to blessedness. Not to submit to error is in itself wrong and pride. Standing